It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. How much of a threat are terrorist-inspired attacks to the United States and Europe? What are the best practices for preventing and responding to violent extremism, and how can they be applied across countries? These are some of the questions to be addressed at a public conference next week hosted by the University of Pittsburgh's European Union Center for International Studies and featuring attendees from across Europe and the United States. I'm joined now by Pitt Associate Professor of International Affairs, Michael Kenny. Michael Kenny, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm fine, Paul. Thank you for having me back.
Is this conference a response to any recent developments in particular, or was it inspired by something else?
It is in response to recent developments both in Europe and the United States. If I had to identify one event, perhaps it would have been the declaration of the caliphate back in June 2014 by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, because that really was a game changer in terms of the transnational, what's sometimes called jihadist phenomenon.
And what makes this particular gathering so valuable?
Well, first of all, anybody that's been following the news in recent months understands how timely the topic is and how important countering violent extremism is, both in Western Europe and the United States. I think one thing that we're hoping to do with this particular conference, what makes it particularly valuable from my perspective, is that we're bringing in a really diverse set of people, people that are doing cutting-edge research, academics, scholars that are doing cutting-edge research in Europe and the United States. But we're also bringing in practitioners, people that are on the front lines of the struggle to counter violent extremism, to turn young men and women away from the allure, from the siren call of the caliphate that is attracting a small number of young people to Iraq and Syria. And then finally, we're even bringing in some people, some what are sometimes called former nonviolent extremists. These were men who, when they were young men, were vulnerable and followed the call of extremist groups, and they were actually themselves involved in different extremist groups.
You're saying they were former nonviolent extremists or violent extremists?
Well, I would say nonviolent extremists.
And what's the – if they were – is the differential here, or how you differentiate based on whether they actually engaged in violence?
Exactly.
As opposed to their intention to engage?
Yeah, exactly, Paul. They weren't bomb makers. They were ideologues. They were people that followed the same set of beliefs, the same ideas, but they were closer, more akin to political activists that were calling for Sharia, that were calling for the creation of a global caliphate long before Abu Bakr and ISIS emerged. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. Activists have been calling for this for years. In the case of
But they
one,
just didn't have a leader to galvanize them?
Well, the groups that I've looked at had leaders. And some of these young men did make the plunge to political violence, but the ones we're bringing in did not.
I see. And so this will be a way for people to kind of get a picture of who's out there that is available to be radicalized by some of these clerics or whoever they might be out there in the world who are trying to engage them in social media and that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's allowing us to understand this phenomenon from a variety of perspectives, not only the scholarly perspective, but also the practitioner's perspective, people that spend their 9-to-5 days, jobs, working to counter the threat, and also people themselves that experienced the allure of extremism.
And the public can attend this event.
It's open to the public.
Right. And we'll give all the particulars, the days, the dates. It's happening next week on the Pitt campus. What do we know or what do we need to know among those of us in the general public in order to understand fully the threat of violent extremism and how to respond to it?
One thing that it's important for us to understand in the general public is that there is no one single cause of violent extremism. That people that fall prey to this, their stories are as varied as there are individuals in the world. You know, for some people, it might be that they are motivated by a set of particular religious slash political beliefs. For other people, it's more about hooking up with friends and basically following them. For other people, it's about the excitement, the youthful excitement and risk-taking, seeking adventure and wanting a jihadi bride and all that other stuff. So the path, there is no one single path to this. There are many multiple paths. And so for us to understand this, that's one of the first things we need to appreciate, is that there is no one single. Another very important thing for us to understand is that a very small number of Muslims are vulnerable to this. And we can't stigmatize larger communities by branding people with certain labels.
Right. I mean, haven't a number of Muslim mosques kicked out people who were advocating violence?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's become harder and harder to spread these sort of extremist ideas in mosques in Western Europe as well as the United States. It's a lot different
because because there isn't a tolerance for that, because it's believed by the leaders of Islam, some, those that aren't radical, that that to engage in this or to advocate violence goes against the beliefs of Islam.
Exactly. And so there is a growing recognition of that.
How much of a threat are terrorist-inspired attacks to the United States and Europe? You know, sometimes if you watch the news, you think that they're all over the place. But there are – and not that they're not dangerous and not to downplay any danger, but we're talking about an isolated few who are ripe for being talked into joining ISIS or traveling to the Middle East and – engaging in, you know, joining some kind of a camp and being trained to engage in warfare.
I think that's
and terror.
I think that's a really important point you just said. They're sometimes referred to as the spectacular few. It is a relatively small number of young men that are vulnerable to this narrative. The vast majority of Muslims, again, whether we're talking about Western Europe or the United States, which is the focus of our conference, are law-abiding. They want the same things that you and I want, you know, good education for their kids, decent jobs. We are talking about a few number of folks. Unfortunately, of that small subset of people, it only takes a few these days to cause a lot of damage with political violence.
Who – paint for me a profile or paint for me a picture or give us a profile of the type of person who would be targeted by radicals if in fact the way to engage them is on the internet, which is seems to be the method of choice. Who is being targeted? You know, who are these individuals?
Okay. The first thing I'd say is that there is no single profile, that we do see a diversity of folks that go over. That said, there are certain characteristics that do tend to crop up. They tend to be young men, okay? They tend to be
– men and not necessarily –
But that said, there are many women that go.
Okay.
You see, that's why it's
mm-hmm.
difficult
sure.
to say there's a single profile.
Okay.
You know, for example – some were raised Muslims, but some weren't. Some are recent converts. We've seen a lot of recent converts to Islam that don't really have a good understanding of the religion. That they've gone over. That's been a problem. So there really is no single profile. Some will be there. They do tend to be young, tend to be male, although there are, as you just pointed out, a growing number of females. They're often disenfranchised and alienated in their societies. They're angry. They are looking for a sense of purpose. They're looking for a sense of identity. And the caliphate and the message and the slick videos and the Twitter feeds resonate with them because they're seeking a sense of belonging and they're seeking a sense of purpose. And for them, that is encapsulated in this idea of, we've got the caliphate now. Come
define
join
what
us.
That is. What, define caliphate.
Well, so the caliphate is basically the historical Islamic empire, okay, that was created at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, but really developed after his death in the subsequent centuries and grew to a pretty large area of the world at a time when empires, this is before nation states, when empires ruled the world. And so one of these empires was the Islamic Empire, which we call the Caliphate. Okay, and so what ISIS is trying to position itself as is a revivalist saying we have now declared the caliphate. So we are the ultimate, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is the ultimate authority. All Muslims need to obey him and come and help us recreate the caliphate.
But and the people that will respond to this are those that, as you described, disenfranchised, angry. It's hard to imagine someone who is happy to be an American and feels like they are a part of the society engaging in this. It would have to be somebody who feels like they're on the outside and who has a desire to disrupt not only activities here in the United States but around the world.
And again, we're talking about a very small number of people that are actually willing to go over there, particularly in the United States. Several European countries have much higher per capita rates of foreign fighters that have gone from Europe to the United States. Belgium, for example, has a pretty high per capita rate relatively versus other countries in Europe. We have a very low rate. So that's good news. It's not something that we need to get hysterical about, but it is, you know, an issue that requires public awareness, and because we need to develop community resilience to help us deal with this threat.
And there was, and certainly it was satire and an exaggeration, but there was a Saturday Night Live skit that you're probably familiar with that addresses this, kind of makes light of the issue of, involves a guy taking his daughter. Presumably he's, sending her off to college. Turns out she's being radicalized and picked up by guys with rifles. And many, many people were offended by this and thought that this is that it was a sign that we're taking this too lightly. So what was your reaction to it?
Well, I mean, I have to be honest, I haven't seen the clip. I didn't see the episode. But, I mean
– essentially what it's doing is making fun of – is saying that we're overreacting to this. And you're saying that it's not necessarily something to get too caught up in, but at the same time, we need to be vigilant.
We need to be vigilant. We need to be aware. But it doesn't help us as a society to get hysterical about it because that ends up being counterproductive. You know, one of the things that happens every time there's an incident like the Charlie Hebdo attack is that there's a backlash against local Muslim communities where people strike out against local available targets, mosques, women walking down the street because they're wearing the hijab. And it always increases the amount of violence against Muslims in those local communities. That's completely counterproductive. That doesn't help us.
We're talking with Michael Kenny. He's a Pitt Associate Professor of International Affairs, and where you're talking about the conference that will take place hosted by the University of Pittsburgh's European Union Center for International Studies next week. It will feature attendees from across Europe and the United States talking about what are the best practices for preventing and responding to violent extremism, how they can be applied across countries. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a comment or question, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. 412-246-2002. Also, our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH. I want to go back to how terrorists are going about identifying and engaging young people with the potential to be radicalized. Is there simply a broad net that is being thrown out on the internet and let's see who we can get caught up in that net? Or are there more messages tailored specifically to the disenfranchised and angry young people, particularly young men in countries like the United States?
Oh, absolutely. ISIS is very good at this. That's one of the strengths of ISIS, is they have a lot of people that are over in Iraq and Syria now, including, I should add, people that I interviewed in my research that at one point in time were activists in the UK, that they were basically propagandists. They went to Syria, and they're now working as propagandists for ISIS. These guys know the West.
They're sitting in a computer, and they are putting out a broad message that someone can maybe find in an internet search or using a search engine. Or I'm picturing a teenager, maybe, you know, Minneapolis. The Minneapolis area seems to be a big target or a big hub for this kind of thing. That there's a kid, you know, a teenager, he's sitting in his computer and all of a sudden something pops up in his email.
There have been stories about some of these online recruiters, for lack of a better term, being very aggressive in terms of once they identify a potential recruit, really zeroing in on that person and tweeting them and sending them emails and trying to get them to interact via other social media. It's a problem. It's a big problem right now, what's happening online. And governments are really struggling over how to counter this effectively.
What are the authorities here and abroad doing to identify this activity, and how do you monitor it without invading people's privacy?
Well, that's one of the challenges, right? Because free speech is one of these critical political rights and civil liberties that we have that define us as a society. And we don't want to destroy the values that make us who we are in order to combat this threat. And that gets us back to the overreaction and avoiding that. There are things that the U.S. government is doing in terms of public outreach, public education, counter-messaging. A lot of it is about counter-messaging. But you know what? Counter-messaging tends to be more effective when it comes from local Muslim communities as opposed to the United States government or the British government. Why? Because for the young kids, the U.S. government has no credibility. Right? Mm. When the State Department unit for countering the message sends out a tweet or posts on its Facebook page, the young kid in, you know, Minnesota or Boston or London or Milan
or Pittsburgh.
It's got no credibility. We need local voices, right? So we need things like.
And I was going to ask you on my list of questions is what can local communities do? And you're saying that probably the people in local communities that have the best credibility are those who were involved with, say, for example, here in Pittsburgh, the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh. And we've interviewed the imam from that center, Atif Magoob, here on this program, and he has disavowed all of the violent extremist behavior that some radical Muslims have engaged in.
Sheikh Atef is a great example of what I'm talking about. Here's a guy who is from Egypt, kind of a classically trained scholar, okay, but lives in the U.S. He's a young guy. He connects with the kids. He's got the religious credibility, the religious knowledge to effectively counter the scriptural interpretations that are put forward by ISIS. So he can do that, but he also connects with young people here in Pittsburgh. I'm really happy that Sheikh Atef decided is joining us next week. He's going to be making one of the presentations on our panel. I believe that's on Thursday.
And I mentioned at the top of the show, a National Guardsman in Illinois arrested recently for allegedly planning an attack on a military post in Illinois. He and his cousin allegedly told an FBI undercover employee their plan for an armed attack on the U.S. military facility when an FBI agent is engaging would-be violent radicals on the internet. How credible is this information? How do we know that either of these two people would have planned, let alone carried out the attack? What if they were just boasting and didn't even mean what they were saying?
It's one of the biggest challenge, I think, that counterterrorism authorities face now, because they don't want to wait too long. You know, if they wait too long and something happened, then that's a disaster. But if they intervene too early, then they're confronted with these sorts of questions. So in that particular case, I don't believe we really know. Was it a case of FBI entrapment? Were these two young, angry young men that, yeah, they were doing talking, but does that mean that they were eventually going to do something on their own?
And I think we have a real problem here, because at the same we want to prevent violent attacks, of course, but at the same time, are we arresting people, or does this kind of vigilance encourage apprehending people who, for all intents and purposes, might never have acted at all and who are now in jail simply because of a conversation they were lured into having with an FBI informant?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I do think that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, what they're doing in these sorts of undercover operations is trying to move beyond conversation. They're trying to get people to take steps. So a person would take a step towards actually acquiring an explosive device or take a step to acquiring firearms. It's at that point that they like to intervene. But the problem is, in order to get people to that step, you have to engage with them. You have to talk with them. And that's where the question lies.
Right, you might be encouraging someone or enlightening them about a step that they weren't aware they even were interested in taking. I get it. It's a very delicate issue, to be sure. Let's take a call from Mitchell in Whitehall, who's been waiting to jump in. Mitchell, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Michael Kenny.
Hi, thank you. It's a great show. I'm enjoying this conversation.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask the professor, since my belief is these kind of things that attract young people is a community of ideas, or we might say on the world level, a war of ideas. And could you describe what role or what effect Saudi Arabia's version of Islam has out there in the world of ideas? The reason I bring it up is I'd read or watched a video recently pointing out a past U.S. foreign policy arrangement with Saudi Arabia. And one of the terms was never to oppose or criticize this special version of Saudi Arabian Islam that was considered really the odd one. I mean, they have polygamy. They support the trafficking of women for the harems, and I don't really know what else.
So you're saying, you're asking Michael, if the Saudi Arabian style of Islam is part of the problem?
Yes.
Okay. Michael, what about it, and is it part of the problem?
It's a question that comes up a lot, because the major interpretation or form of Islam that is practiced in Saudi Arabia is called Salafism, or more pejoratively, it's called Wahhabism. Wahhabism tends to be a pejorative. Salafism is a term that's more acceptable to folks inside the kingdom. Salafism is a fundamentalist interpretation of the religion. It has a reputation for not being perhaps as tolerant as some other strands of Islam. The problem is that people that have engaged in political violence, both in the West and in the Middle East, self-identify themselves as Salafis. They call themselves Salafis. So it tends to paint the entire branch of Salafism with this violent brush. But it's very important to keep in mind that most Salafis not only have nothing to do with violence, they're actually apolitical. That's one of the things that Salafism is known for, is it's like an apolitical interpretation. Don't get involved in politics. Your focus as a good Muslim should be on your own salvation and being the best Muslim that you can be in your daily life. Those are sometimes called Salafi purists. Okay? Then you have a second subset, which are called Salafi politicos. These are Salafis, but they're also political activists. They work in democratic systems to bring about peaceful change in a way that they favor. And then finally, you have a third set, which are sometimes called Salafi jihadis. And these are the folks, a subset of that would be like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So there's a big debate now going on about the role of Salafism in this, and it's an ongoing debate. The jury's still out, but I do think it's important to know that Salafism, I mean, there's millions and millions and millions of Salafis in the world today. A very small number of them who call themselves Salafis have engaged in terrorist attacks.
We've been talking with Michael Kenny. He's Associate Professor of International Affairs at Pitt. Next week, there is a conference taking place at the University of Pittsburgh, sponsored and hosted by the University of Pittsburgh's European Union Center for International Studies, featuring attendees from across Europe and the United States talking about how to prevent and respond to violent extremism. And again, the dates on that are
Thursday, April 9th, and Friday, April 10th, pretty much all day, both days. But people can just come to the panels they want to go to.
And we can link to that information on our website at WESA.FM. We've come to time for this statement, for this segment, but thank you for all of your statements. Michael Kenny, we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me, Paul. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up today is World Autism Awareness Day. We'll spotlight a Squirrel Hill organization working to place adults on the autism spectrum in STEM jobs. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today is World Autism Awareness Day, and there's good news for a couple of local organizations that focus on the condition. Aetna-based Autism Connection of Pennsylvania and Career Development Center of Squirrel Hill have received $200,000 in grant funding to provide free job placement and related services for people with mental health challenges. And the partnership is off to a strong start. 30 people out of 60 enrolled have been placed in jobs in the last 6 months. The Career Development Center is working to improve workforce readiness for jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM jobs, among adults on the autism spectrum. Pennsylvania is expected to have over 300,000 job openings in science, technology, engineering, and math by 2018. I'm joined now in Studio A by April Arts. She is coordinator for the Employable program, if I'm saying that right, at the Squirrel Hill Career Development Center. Welcome, April.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And with us by phone is Lou Randall, Executive Director of Autism at the Autism Connection of Pennsylvania. Hello, Lou.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Is there a stigma, and I'll throw this out to either April or Lou, is there a stigma when people with autism or another mental health issue go to apply for a job? What problems do adults with mental health issues face when inserted unprepared into a work environment?
So, Lou, if you're comfortable, I feel like I can take this and then you can tag team.
Sure.
So one of the things that I think is really important for people to understand is that sort of mental health issues or autism, this is not really a subset of our population. This is sort of part of being a human. And so, you know, one in four adults will experience a mental health issue in any given year. So that's 25%. There are more than 3.5 million million Americans who live with an autism spectrum disorder. So these folks are all around us. We know them. We might be them. And so really, when people go to apply for a job, there's still a lot of concern on their end about disclosing or talking about it to their employer. And I think in some ways that is justified because there's still a lot of misunderstanding. Despite the fact this is very prevalent and this is just sort of being a human, we still have a lot of stigma and anxiety around this and sort of the unknownness, those of us who don't work in the mental health field. And then as far as problems that people face when they're inserted unprepared, that is something that we see a lot. So we get a lot of people who they have previously held jobs, but if they're on the autism spectrum, they may have had some difficulties socially. They may not have understand sort of the hierarchy and how you're supposed to be communicating to a supervisor. There's a variety of sort of things that can kind of go awry that you maybe wouldn't expect. And then for people
with... Can I give an example of that?
Yeah, go ahead, Lou.
So we've got a friend who's an autistic adult, and that tends to be the way that my autistic friends like to be referred to as adults. We learn a lot about person-first language, but autism is their culture, and they really want to engage with that. So he worked in a company. He was an IT specialist. And the president of the company came by his cubicle, and it was the president was in for his birthday, and they were going to have, like, a birthday celebration. And my friend looked down and worked harder because he was hired to do the work, and he was basically exhibiting his work behavior. But it came off as rude and sort of disrespectful. So he did come into a lot of consequences from that one scenario. So that's sort of an idea that I like to think about, that we do have people around us. They may already work with us in our corporations. They may appear a little bit different socially, but they get a heck of a lot of work done. Just socially, sometimes they're a little bit different. But
you bring up a great point. And Lou, we're having a little trouble boosting your phone volume here.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is reconnect with you to make sure we can hear you better. Is that
okay.
All right?
All right.
Okay, thank you. And we'll reconnect once again with Lou Randall, Executive Director at Autism Connection. But she made a good point there, April, and that is that people with autism, while this is considered or falls under the heading of mental health disorder, these are people with extraordinary intellects and who can – you want to find ways to bring these people into the workforce because they have exceptional skills, particularly in the STEM field, correct?
That is correct. And so we have a lot of people that I'm working with who are in the IT fields, have engineering degrees. That's not to say we don't have people in some of the other fields as well. I mean, there's this saying in the autism community that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, meaning that everyone is an individual. But yes, we have people who are very detail-oriented, very good with schematics, very good with following protocols. These are their skill sets. So if people are willing to sort of overlook a little bit of quirkiness or a little bit of difficulty around the social nuances, they oftentimes will have someone who is very intelligent and very productive who will stay with the company for quite a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think we've all had our experiences with people who are, as they say, on the autism spectrum. I remember as a drama teacher one time working with a student who had a hard time making eye contact with you. But this particular individual was able to perform in plays, was often off book, as they say, or had memorized his lines sooner than anybody else in the cast, but and also understood the depth and ranges of emotions that he needed to express in character. So there is not only equal ability, but sometimes extraordinary ability above and beyond among these particular individuals.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I really try to stress to employers when I meet with them is that just because someone doesn't interview well doesn't mean that they don't have the skills to do the job. Most people are nervous when they go on interviews, but people with autism may have difficulty making eye contact or may answer questions very literally as opposed to giving kind of more nuanced answers. But as you said, with that student that you knew in that drama program, if it is connected to what they're interested in, they can really shine and really do quite well in whatever field that they are in.
So Lou is back on the line with us, Lou Randall. So in what ways does the Autism Connection and CDC hope to ease the transition into a job and lessen the problems that get in the way of people being able to fully engage in their talents?
I think that opportunities like this, and I'm first going to ask, can you hear me now?
We can.
Yay. So opportunities like this, we really really value quite a lot. So I see my role in particular as providing a kind of a cross-cultural explanation of a group that's really not well understood. And it's very similar when we listen to the issues to any other minority groups in the past or currently who have a hard time being taken seriously, being respected, not having stereotypes put out there that are untrue. So we work together. I go out and talk to employers, and I'm welcoming any opportunity to go out and talk about autism, about how it appears across the lifespan, about how the brain is different, and people find the science very interesting. So, for instance, there are too many nerve cells in the brain of a person with autism that create a little bit of difficulty when they have too much light, too much sound. Things might be a little bit difficult. That's one of the things that makes things like eye contact hard. I can listen to you, I can respond to you, but I can't always engage in all the social cultural things that we as Americans kind of expect. That doesn't mean I don't have an IQ of 170, which, you know, I lean on a lot of my autistic friends to solve my IT problems, to do photography for me, to work on my web design. I hire people, you know, at Autism Connection as contractors quite often. So we really try to work together and put the message out there about the benefits, about hiring a person with autism or mental health challenges. And one of the benefits in particular is when you have a new person coming in and they process things a little bit differently, you've got to analyze your processes, your culture, your expectations. And often the larger corporations that have done this successfully, like Walgreens or places like that, like Lowe's, they will look at their corporate culture or their traditions and say, you know, we're wasting a lot of time on these meetings, perhaps. Let's just cut that out. So they're sort of looking and streamlining and getting more to the meat of the heart of their issues, and their bottom line does go up because of that.
Well, so there's the part of this that involves the training and connecting people with autism to these STEM jobs. Does the CDC and the Autism Connection follow up with members once they have been placed in a job? You might have addressed this earlier, but I wanted to come back to this and talk about it because, you know, there's the training, but then there's once you've got the job, I'm guessing there has to be some follow-up.
So, Lou, you're okay if I take this one?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So Lou does our training for us. She goes out and talks to the employers, and then what I do is I coordinate the program and I meet with clients. And so when I meet with clients for the first session, one of the things I always tell them is once you get a job, we're not just going to say congratulations, good luck, see ya. We continue to serve as a safety net for them, and we will support them to whatever level makes sense for their needs and the employer's needs. So for some people, if it makes sense for us to go into the workplace and sort of do a little coaching and a little support that way, we can do that as long as the employer is on board and welcoming it. For some people, they just touch base with us. They will continue to meet with us and problem solve separately things that are coming up in the workplace. And for some people, they might initially go in, things seem fine, but then something happens and they say, April, I need your help. And so then I'm happy to step in and support them and collaborate with the employer as is appropriate. So it's really individualized, but we stick around and we really make sure we continue to support them.
And how successful have they been? Is the CDC using some way of gauging their level of success?
Absolutely. So we strive to see someone placed for at least 6 months. Of course, we want that longer, but as far as the placements that we're tracking, we're looking to see people placed for 6 months. We have people who were placed in the summer and early fall and are still at that job. And so we have people who have connected with meaningful employment and are continuing in that job and doing quite well.
And Lou, it sounds like employers who are willing to give these folks a chance. They gain reliable employees who are loyal, and from what we're seeing so far, at least, or what we've been told, is that the turnover rates among people who get these jobs is, and those in general with mental health disabilities, are low.
Right, right. I mean, I think part of in our program, particularly, you know, April and the employee seeking a job find a really good match. We find matches with people who have high interest in that area. But the low turnover really, I think, is a reflection of the people that I've talked to, and I survey my autistic adult friends. They've got the depth of knowledge. They love seeing that they make a difference, so they're going to pick a job that is meaningful to them. They love to be on teams of people who take their jobs very seriously, and they just appreciate that, you know, they want to go into their field and do the best job that they can possibly do. And I think that as taxpayers, you know, we spend a lot of money on some people's education, special education, and it's lovely to see that we've got this large crop of people right now coming out of college who want to be taxpayers, and by and large, they want to give back, and they want to just be productive members of society like everybody else.
So where do we see this going in the future, April? Will there be perhaps an expansion on the horizon? Because we're looking at, 300, the exact number, or rounding it out, is 314,000 job openings in science, technology, engineering, and math fields, many of which can potentially be filled by people on the autism spectrum.
Right. And so since day one, my goal for this program and the other people I work with, our goal has been to replicate this program because we recognize that this will benefit Pittsburgh, but it can benefit a lot of other areas as well. And so we're really hoping to develop a quality program that really meets the needs of the people we work with so that then we can spread that elsewhere. And I would also say that one of the ways that we can really do this is if any employers are receptive and they reach out to us, because the more employers we can connect to, the more we can connect them to valuable employees.
Lou, a same question for you, just as far as where this will go, how much you see this expanding in the future if expansion plans are in the works?
Right. Well, I think we've got nowhere to go but up with this. We've got more and more people with autism entering the workforce. And as they're sort of groundbreaking people and the pioneers that are out there right now can show what a benefit to the bottom line of the company and to the work culture and all that we're going to have more and more people coming behind them. And they'll be, at certain points, the managers or the hiring people that will kind of bring people behind them as well.
That's Lou Randall, Executive Director at Autism Connection of Pennsylvania, joining us by phone. Lou, thank you for joining us and for rejoining us. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
And April Arts is coordinator for the Employ Able program at the Squirrel Hill Career Development Center, joining me here in Studio A. April, nice meeting you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBom on where to go for that Final Four action. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's April, and March Madness is still at the forefront of office pools and sports pages. As the Final Four gets ready to play, contributor Elaine LaBom, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, has some travel suggestions connected to the teams headed to the big dance, or from one big dance to another big dance. Elaine LaBom, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How you doing, Paul?
I'm good. I didn't change that because I like just saying big dance, but I guess big dance is like the whole tournament. But it's like a bigger dance if you're in the Final Four, right?
Well, it's huge. And it's funny how it seems to be a lot of the same teams every year. Teams go through those runs. There was that era of like UNLV doing very well, and it seems now all we hear about is Kentucky and whatnot, and not that I'm trying to prognosticate or anything, but it seems that's what happens in the big dance.
So, all right. So for any intrepid travelers out there who want to get up close and personal with the various tournament participants, your first foray would be to Wisconsin. That's one of the teams. The Badgers are in there.
Yeah, they're in the Final Four. And, this is it's a great school and a great story. It's in Madison. It's a large school, 40,000 students.
Madtown's great.
I've been to Madtown. Isn't it? It's a fun place. It's a sprawling campus. It's got that, kind of, as I like to say, that kind of crunchy feel to it, very inviting and whatnot. And I think they have to be super excited to be in the big dance. And you know what? It's not inconceivable that you can get there for a weekend and try to get in with some of that energy that they've got going there, being in the tournament, in the Final Four. But for me, at least, when you get to Wisconsin, you can't miss Milwaukee. I know you're sort of familiar with that part of the
world. Been to Milwaukee, too. That's a great town as well.
Love Milwaukee. And what I would say is if you do get out to Wisconsin to soak up some of the energy of that school and the excitement, do not miss the tour of the Harley-Davidson factory, and absolutely get yourself to that Milwaukee public market. And, of course, I'm in here talking at lunchtime, so we're going to talk food.
There's no shortage of food in those places.
There is not, but I can tell you that I had the best peanut butter cookie in the universe at the Milwaukee public market. It's the only time I actually bought a second peanut butter cookie at the C. Adams Bakery. We're talking a very traditional place, Milwaukee. They've got those old-timey bakeries. Let me tell you, those grandmas, they know how to bake. I'm sure there was more butter than peanut butter in my cookie, but I didn't care.
I remember going to see the Brewers at the old County Stadium, and just the smell of that place. You smelled like you were in a bakery/sausage factory.
And you probably were.
Yeah, they were making it up.
There you go.
All right, now you also like Kentucky for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, now I'm not saying that this is going to be the winner of the tournament, Paul. I wouldn't.
They are undefeated, though.
How's Notre Dame feeling right about now, huh?
Like they could have been there. They almost won.
That was so close. But yeah, you know, again, this is a storied basketball school, and you probably know the names better than I do. Adolf Rupp, is that how he pronounced
it?
Yeah,
he was the legendary coach.
He won 4 of their 8 NCAA titles, I believe, if I've got it right. Didn't he coach for something like 40 years?
He was there a long time.
He was there a very long time. But yeah, 8 titles.
Rick Pitino won there.
Yes.
John Calipari
won the most recent one, right?
Yes, and he's from Pittsburgh, from Moon Township. Well, so there's a Pittsburgh connection.
You scooped me. There you go. Well, and you know, actually, a friend of mine is from Lexington, and she's going to be there this weekend for the fun. But that probably is the most exciting place to go experience the Final Four this weekend.
Do you want to go there now, or do you want to wait till the Kentucky Derby?
You took the words right out of my mouth. I think I would try to do both. I mean, it's kind of like sort of sports nirvana over there in Kentucky right about now, because you've got the team is in the Final Four, you know, probably the odds-on favorite. You can just go down the road to Louisville. And what do you want to do just ahead of baseball season? You go to the Louisville Slugger Factory and Museum right there in Louisville, just down the road. And then if you don't get there till next month, you're right. You've got Churchill Downs and the Kentucky Derby. So Kentucky is place number one for sports travelers right now. But I can hardly imagine a more exciting place than the University of Kentucky right now for the Final Four. They've had a tremendous season.
And you'd also like to show some love to Utah, which was in the Sweet 16.
You know, to me, they're just sort of like that sort of like sentimental favorite. I don't know why. The little engine that could. It's like they make it and they get close. I think they've actually made it to the Final Four once, maybe even to the final. They only got to the Sweet 16 this year, but you know, they've got
They were in the Final Four, I think. It was
I believe they
98,
were
98, 99. Once. Somewhere
no,
in
I
there.
Wouldn't.
But what
I
do
wouldn't.
You do in Utah?
listen to you.
Well, I've never been there.
Okay, to me, this is the place where you go for the great outdoors. And now that it's spring, and some of the national parks there, and the spring flowers in bloom. Oh my goodness, I would go to Arches National Park, Bryce, and my favorite, Zion National Park. Some of the best hiking trails. My favorite all-time trail, Angel's Landing, arguably, you know, the most beautiful and yet the most terrifying hiking trail in a national park. So lots to do there.
We're talking with our travel contributor, Elaine LaBalm. She's coming up with travel suggestions based on teams that have been in the NCAA tournament or who are now a part of the Final Four. They didn't get to the Final Four, but Arizona was in the Elite Eight. Now, Arizona, that seems like an interesting place, if for no other reason than the Grand Canyon is there.
The Grand Canyon is there, and we've talked about Phoenix on this program. But what we're going to talk about right now is exactly where Arizona is. And the University of Arizona, a lot of people think it's in Phoenix, but it's in Tucson, the very southern edge of the state, almost in Mexico. And this is the land of the saguaro cactus, the tallest cactus that you will find – cacti, excuse me – that you will find anywhere are there, along with Saguaro National Park, which a lot of people think, oh, you know – you go into the desert if you're going to go see all these cacti. And in fact, you will. But what they don't realize is that this national park also has a tremendous sort of mountain hiking phase to it. The tallest mountain there, Mica Mountain, is almost 9,000 feet tall. So you can combine, you know, the desert landscape experience with some great mountain hiking trails. Of course, you get to the Grand Canyon and you're way up there. High as well.
That sounds like I've always wanted to go. Maybe this is the year. Last but not least, if you're not going to go see games in person, can you suggest an iconic sports bar or two that would make for a fun spot from which to watch?
Well, you know, what I would say is a couple of places that are sort of basketball-ish. You know, think about going to Philly and cheering on the fans who from Villanova who were so close and were expected to win. Oh,
they beat Pitt a few years ago. They crushed our dreams. I'm not going to feel sorry for them.
I'm showing Philly the love. They were the favorites. I'm saying go to Center City, find yourself a good pub, or go to Cleveland. Go to one of the sports bars near the Q. I mean, you know, the LeBron and the Cavs, they are the big story in basketball this year. That's a couple of good ideas. If you want to stay in town, hey, any Primanti. Go have that colossal fish sandwich. You got, 25 TV screens and lots of cheering
fans.
That's
where you're headed right now. Elaine LaBalm, our travel contributor. Great thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Tomorrow we talk rock and roll on the show, and Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues will be with us. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.